Hello, and thank you for listening to Raleigh Little Theater's podcast in support of our production of Perfect Arrangement by Topher Payne. I'm Patrick Torres, and I'm the artistic director here at Raleigh Little Theater, and it's also my great privilege to be the director of this wonderful script. So we wanted to create a series of podcasts for you in order to give you insight into this play. Because it's the first time this play has ever been produced in North Carolina, and we are really excited to be the venue that is bringing it to you. So in support of the production, I interviewed three people who will give you insight into the play, help us understand its themes, and also just give us some insight into how relevant the play is today. But first, I wanted to give you a synopsis of the play. It's 1950, and new colors are being added to the Red Scare. Two U.S. State Department employees, Bob and Norma, have been tasked with identifying sexual deviants within their ranks. There's just one problem. Both Bob and Norma are gay, and have married each other's partners as a carefully constructed cover-up. The play was inspired by true events in 1950, known as the Lavender Scare, where the State Department did actually start identifying these folks and firing them, rendering them incapable of finding future employment and just being outcast in society. When I was first handed this play a year ago, I just couldn't put it down, and I loved it so much, and I was really grateful when we decided to put it on our season. This first podcast, you'll hear from playwright Topher Payne. Topher has been a great partner as I've gotten to know him, and I'm really excited that we are producing his play, and I'm thrilled that he's so excited about our production. So without further ado, here is my interview with playwright Topher Payne. I'm talking with Topher Payne, the playwright of Perfect Arrangement, on the telephone from Atlanta right now. Is that where you are right now, Topher?
That's where I am this week.
Well, thank you for joining us. We are thrilled to be doing your play and just really excited to have it on our season.
I am thrilled for any production, but anytime I can get one in the South, it feels like a particular victory. And so I'm very, very excited.
Why does it feel like a victory to have it produced in the South?
Because it's interesting. You know, when we did the Off-Broadway production, we had high school matinees at this show. And so the Primary Stages production, there was no hesitation about presenting this neglected chapter in American history to teenagers. Whereas when productions happen in the South, the exact same material is seen as mature content, which I think is really, really interesting. And I think it's something that Perfect Arrangement addresses itself, is trying to reframe this as the very human story that it is and a uniquely American story, rather than people simply seeing that, you know, our central characters are representative of the LGBTQ community and assuming, you know, oh, well, then this is very, you know, this is for adults only. So, you know, it all goes back to just my, you know, complicated love-hate relationship with the place I call home.
Why don't you tell our audiences a little bit about how this play was born, where the idea came from you, and just your process of writing it and creating it.
Yeah, I used to work at the late great Outright bookstore in Atlanta, which was a tremendous resource for the gay community in the 90s and early 2000s. And it has since, you know, gone the way of a whole lot of small independent bookstores. And when I was working there at the time, a book called The Lavender Scare by David K. Johnson came out, and I got an advanced copy of that and was introduced to the story of The Lavender Scare itself. Everyone, of course, is very familiar with the Red Scare of the early 1950s. It's, you know, something that's entered into our vernacular. It's so familiar. But this second story of what they did next when they expanded the definition of security risk beyond suspected communists to suspected homosexuals, drunkards, and loose women. And our own government was really attempting to root us out and remove us from any positions of influence. And it was the removal of those people who were well-educated, committed to American government service, you know, in the real definition of patriotism. And now they were cast out with these blotches on their resumes and nothing to lose. And that became the earliest stirrings of the contemporary American gay rights movement. And this was a chapter in our history that I certainly had never been taught, and everybody I turned to was unfamiliar with it as well. And when I get pissed off enough to say something has to be communicated, that's when I tend to write a play. Mm-hmm. And that's where Perfect Arrangement started to come together.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think so many of us with knowledge of LGBT history really think of Stonewall as the beginning of that movement. But like researching your play now that I'm working on it and kind of reading up, I've also been surprised about how much activity there was before 1969 when Stonewall happened.
We're talking about events that happened nearly 20 years prior, you know? And, you know, when you consider the dramatic strides that the queer community has made since 1997, if you're framing it within the same timeline, and you consider where we were in the 90s versus where we are today, for good and for ill, you really start to get a sense of the difference, the difference between where things were in the Stonewall era versus where we are in the spring of 1950.
You said that the kind of when you get pissed off, that's when a play starts to rise. So was there something specific in that research, or was it just the general idea of the Lavender Scare, or was it a personal story that kind of launched it?
You know, I was 28, I guess, when I started working in earnest on Perfect Arrangement, and probably, you know, 26 when I first read the book. I think it's part of the natural evolution that we have as, you know, as a queer culture. We have that tendency, first you're just amazed to find a tribe of people who accept and embrace you for who you are. And then as you mature and as you ensconce yourself as a true member of that community, you become interested in your own history and the history of your people. And this was my first real deep dive into the history of the culture that, you know, that I identify with, and really gaining a respect and really just being gobsmacked by the kind of bravery that was required for someone to choose to live an authentic life in that time. This is certainly something that has not gone away. You know, there's not a single fear that the gay and lesbian characters in Perfect Arrangement have that are not currently being experienced by the trans community. Because when people get afraid of something, there's only so many reactions that they have in their arsenal. And so we all tend to be, they tend to attempt to suppress us in very, very similar ways. And then it just becomes a matter of who the current target is. And I was interested in exploring the story of a group of people just before they make the choice to stand up for themselves, and just before they make the choice to live an authentic life. And that's, there's a farce and a frustration to the act of passing, to trying to present yourself the way you believe the world wants to see you. It's very, very sad, of course, and it's also kind of ridiculous. And that was when I started to discover that the story really wanted to be a comedy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because the play does have, I believe, so much to say about just social circumstance and, you know, so much that we can learn culturally. But it's interesting that it is a comedy in the beginning, at least. And so talk to us a little bit about that. Why the comic mode for such a serious topic?
Because if you want people to listen, the best way to do it is to make them laugh. It disarms people. Laughter is one of the most unrestrained things we can do. Everybody believes they have a goofy laugh, you know? Everybody, if you ever hear a recording of your laugh, which unfortunately, to my own horror, I do often, it's such an unrestrained and uncontrolled response, and it's the breaking down of a barrier. And so when I want an audience to pay attention, you don't preach at them. You make them laugh. You let them drop their armor a little bit. And then they lean in because they're hoping you're going to make them laugh again. So that's the big idea behind why everything I've ever written can, to some degree, be described as a comedy. I prefer to think of my work as funny people in very serious situations. Mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, all comedy really is. And the stakes are high, you know? And because the stakes are so high, you get those belly laughs as well as, you know, the moments when you jerk their hearts out. I loved the idea of, in Perfect Arrangement, the Martindales and the Baxters being inspired by popular culture of the time. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out what straight people act like at home. And so they're basing this on issues of House Beautiful and episodes of I Love Lucy. They're taking the pop culture of the time while they're dealing with what was on the cover of the New York Times that week. And we tend to remember eras in 20th century American history based on the popular culture, not what was happening in the newspaper. So you think of the 50s and you think of Lucy, you think of June Cleaver and the music of the era, you think of James Dean, you think of Elvis Presley, you don't think of this very, very significant and very public persecution of suspected homosexuals. That's not what you think of when you think of the 50s. And so I wanted to play with the audience's expectations of giving them visually what they're accustomed to, but content-wise, exploring something that, for most of them, is very new.
That's so interesting. And, you know, for those of us not in the LGBT community, I think another brilliant thing about that kind of sitcom, I Love Lucy style beginning, it allows us to feel familiar in a culture that is not necessarily our own. And so we start to see ourselves and we start to recognize at least motifs and characters that we've identified as part of our common nostalgia for a long time. And it allows us to get closer to them. I think I've been saying this and I just believe it's true that this play is about and celebrates the LGBT community and a part of the activism that we don't really ever hear about. But it also, like, I think for all of us, for no matter who sees the play, I think it challenges us to think about what we are willing to sacrifice for justice. You know?
Exactly.
And I don't think we have, it wouldn't have the power that it has if you didn't create a scenario where we do get to relate to these people, even if they are different from us.
The arrangement in the play does not really begin to fall apart until the men and women are in opposition to each other, until the men start giving in to some of their own worst impulses in the name of self-preservation, which that is certainly not a story that is unique to the queer community. And I think that's one of the larger messages about the show. One of the things that I think resonates now even more than it did when I first workshopped it 8 years ago, and will probably always be true of the work, is it speaks to everything doesn't fall apart until they stop working together, until they start turning on their own allies. And when they are no longer capable of listening to each other, to receiving new information, to finding some way to present a united front in the face of people who would seek to divide them, that's when everything falls apart. And that really, really has gained particular resonance for me personally in the last year.
Mm. Hey, so I have I may edit all this out. I'm just going to go ahead and record it at the moment. But I just wanted to say to you, I am not in the LGBTQ community. I do hope that I am an ally. I consider myself that and hope to be. But I wanted to say to you, just kind of on a personal level, my brother was a gay man. And he spent his life, he passed away last year at 42. He was my big brother. And he spent his life living very hidden lives, really. We grew up in church together, and then the church really wounded us because of his homosexuality. And he walked away from that for a while. And then right before he passed, he had started reconnecting with a spiritual journey. And that was pretty amazing. And one of the last conversations I had with him, he talked about how he felt like saying to all of his friends in the LGBT community that it was almost as scary as coming out again to say that he was going to church. And so I read your play and it just made me immediately feel reconnected with my brother and some of the things that he had to go through here as my best friend and as someone that I love so much. And your play hits at the humanity of that hidden part of who he was and the things that I watched him struggle with in private that he was scared to share publicly. And I don't know that I'm the right person to direct it, but I'm going to do my best because it is such a story that is so truthful for me and my family. And I'm imagining many other people who have to live a life that they feel they need to keep secret. So thank you so much for letting us do it.
And thank you, first of all, for that. And it's, one of the things that really stands out to me about the play, as I've continued to get to know it better, that's the beautiful thing, is theater is a living creature. When I write a film, then that is, the definitive artistic expression of that screenplay, whereas as a play, it lives on and it's interpreted under new circumstances by new teams of artists. And shame is a very, very powerful weapon to use against any community. The best way to suppress someone's instinct to live their most authentic life is to first convince them that they don't have a right to ask for it. And that is... that's a tactic that's been used since time immemorial, but I gotta tell you, the American South has really perfected the art form of it. And as a gay man who is also a Christian and is equally proud of both of those details about me, and I have many, many other interesting things about me, recognizing the difference between my relationship with my creator and my relationship with organized religion took some time, and it's something that I have had to explain to quite a few people, because so many of us were raised in environments where we were taught that we did not have the right to express ourselves as the people that we were authentically created to be. just with this play, but anytime I put pen to paper, I believe I was put on this earth to try and facilitate conversations, to inspire people to see the world a little differently. And as artists, and as people willing to go to the theater, there is this beautiful contract that we're signing with each other where they're going to give us a couple of hours of their time, and by God, we are going to say something. And that's why, you know, to go back to what we were talking about in the beginning, my relationship with productions of this play in the South definitely mean more to me personally, because I know the influences affecting those artists and those audiences, and I'm very, very proud to have the chance to tell them a story that I think really matters.
Well, thank you so much, Topher. We will do our best, our very best, to take care of this amazing story, and we're really excited about the conversation that you start in the play, and we hope to continue it and to inspire audiences to talk with each other and come to a greater understanding and to work together like you've inspired us to do, to solve the things
and to do it in such fabulous costumes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
So I hope you enjoyed my interview with Topher Payne, the playwright of Perfect Arrangement, and I hope that it's made you even more excited to see our show. In the next podcast, I interview James Miller, who's the executive director of the LGBT Center here in Raleigh. And on the final podcast, I interview Christopher Brook, who's the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union here in North Carolina. And they will give you some great insight into this play and how it affects our lives now. We hope to see you at the theater, and we thank you for listening.